And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Greetings, adventurers. You're listening to The Quiet Journeys of Professor Atwood with me, Professor Atwood. I'm glad you're here, and I can't wait to tell you about my latest journey. Don't worry, it's a safe space. I'll handle all the danger for you. I designed these stories to help you relax, chill anxiety, and go to sleep. Maybe they'll even put a smile on your face, even if it's a sleepy smile. So please, settle in, relax, and prepare to quietly drift off with me to parts known, unknown, and even some places in between. Comfortable? Very well. Let's get underway. Good evening, adventurers. I hope you're doing well. I also hope you're warm, settled in, and ready for what will be another interesting story about preparing to go into outer space. This evening, I'm going to tell you all about the continuation of the abbreviated astronaut training some of my crew had to go through in order to be fit for space duty. As you remember from last time, there was an early complication with one crew member, Beverly, our space chef, but she called her one-time oceanic chef rival, Jillian, and filled her own vacancy before I was even aware of her not doing so well on the NASA centrifuge. The rest of the crew did do well, but the training was going to get more complicated from here on out, and I was hoping everyone would pass the remaining training modules. We were short on time, and I wanted to get into space and to Mars as soon as possible, as did Janet, our mission specialist, who was still being a bit cryptic about certain parts of the mission. Dolores, our security guard slash mercenary, had no trouble with the centrifuge, and I thought it would be a good idea to get some of the issues with secrecy out of the way early, as Dolores was not a big fan of secrets and subterfuge, and it took a while for her to trust Byron on our last journey. Now, that was completely understandable, as he was a hidden pirate, after all. I mean, she said she trusted him in the end, but she still watched him surreptitiously to make sure he wasn't up to any residual nefarious pirate shenanigans. Now, as you know, Byron ended up being a valuable and essential member of our crew, but I don't think Dolores ever fully trusted him. But to be fair, she wouldn't be so good at her job if she did. But she made her suspicion look casual, to the point of not even being noticeable. She was just that good at her job. So when Dolores met the secret of mission specialist Janet, things went about as well as I expected. They were both polite and cordial, but they both made it clear they weren't budging either. Janet would reveal no more information than was necessary at the time, and Dolores made it clear that she would be watching everything and everyone at all times. Janet then mentioned Dolores' astrophobia, the fear of being in outer space, and I don't think the timing was exactly perfect, as it put Dolores casually on guard a bit, something I was trying to avoid. But Janet offered support and assistance to help her overcome it through the mission, and I believe she was sincere. Honestly, it was hard not to like Janet. She was friendly, affable, and went out of her way to make things work. It was just the secrecy that was a little off-putting, but she assured me we would have all the information we needed when we needed it. Now it was time for Janet and myself to supervise the next phase of the truncated astronaut training, and I will tell you all about it in a moment. But first, I need to tell you about a few other things. I wanted to mention this again and say that I hope you enjoyed the crossover episode with Professor Scooter. We did something new and had a guest speaker over to the lab, and it's always nice to try new things. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it and followed up and familiarized yourself with some of his original scientific research. It can be quite fascinating. Also, I wanted to mention a note about our stories here. They are designed for you to drift in and out of, and while yes, I do like to tell you a full story every episode, drifting in and out or falling completely asleep is factored into the equation. You could pick things up anywhere, as that's why I do the story recaps at the beginning. And if you're here, awake, and hanging on every word, well, I'm flattered. And we try to add additional flourishes and flavor in there just for you. So by all means, enjoy the show any way you wish. It's designed that way. No rules, my friends. I'd also like to nudge you to rate the show with a bunch of stars. Reviews are great too. It's always nice to read pleasant things about what we're doing over here. And also, don't forget to tell your friends directly about the show and post about it wherever you post about things. Now, before I mention the White Cat Adventures Club, I want to remind you that we've created a Science and Adventure Helper donation link on the homepage. So just go to whitecatentertainment.com and click Donate for a one-time donation. But if you do want more, there's the White Cat Adventures Club. You can get early access and ad-free listening to all the shows and an exclusive look at my very, semi-regular journal. Science and Exploring is expensive, and your support helps make it happen. And you have access to all the archive content right away as soon as you join up. And it's just $5 a month, and you can show your support for the show. There's different tiers with different rewards, including an exclusive t-shirt. So please, go to patreon.com/whitecatentertainment and enjoy the access your way. All right, then. Let's get back to the story. Now, the first thing I did was check in on the crew members back at my home lab, where my ship, the Journeyman's Hangar, was located. The truth was, I didn't have my own gantry, so I did have to coordinate with NASA to use their special Southern California gantry whenever I needed to launch. It was hidden near the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. It's one of the unadvertised NASA gantries and launch sites. Sure, I mean, I could subcontract with a tech billionaire to use one of theirs, but honestly, they just fee you out the door, and it's always easier just to deal with NASA. I'd rather have the extra paperwork than try to navigate a labyrinth of hidden space launch fees because a billionaire is trying to make up for losses elsewhere. Anyway, I spoke with Barry, our flight commander and pilot. He said things were going well and on track, and he said he enjoyed working with Kara, our flight engineer. She was going through all the safety checklists, getting the journeyman ready for launch. She was having a little trouble with the relativity dampeners, but I told her not to worry about it as it wasn't that long of a flight, just to Mars, and the theory of relativity wouldn't kick in enough to really make too much of a difference. It wasn't a deal breaker. Barry and Kara told me the journeyman would be all fueled up and on the JPL hidden gantry in a few days if everything went according to plan. I said that was excellent news and look forward to the next report and update. So far, we were using our time as efficiently as possible without cutting corners, which I knew would be the key to this mission's success. Now it was time for me to turn my attention back to my new astronauts. Next on the training program was on-orbit operations. You see, astronauts are trained in preparation for the conditions of launch as well as the harsh environment of space. This training aims to prepare the crews for events falling under two broad categories: events relating to operation of the spacecraft, or internal events, and events relating to the space environment, which are, of course, external events. As I said before, this training especially would be abbreviated, as we would have artificial gravity on the journeyman, And there was artificial gravity already. Okay, again, I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, if things went well, there would be minimal need for spacewalks. But you never know, so it's always good to be prepared. First up was system training, which is considered part of internal events. Okay, so during training, astronauts are familiarized with the engineering systems of the spacecraft, including spacecraft propulsion, spacecraft thermal control, and life support systems. In addition to this, astronauts receive training in orbital mechanics, scientific experimentation, Earth observation, and astronomy. This training is particularly important for missions when an astronaut will encounter multiple systems, for example, on the International Space Station. Training is performed in order to prepare astronauts for events that may pose a hazard to their health, the health of the crew, or something that may prevent the successful completion of the mission. These types of events may be failure of a critical life support system, capsule depressurization, fire, or other unpleasant space events. In addition to the need to train for hazardous events, astronauts will also need to train to ensure the successful completion of their mission. This could be in the form of training for EVA, extravehicular activity or spacewalking, scientific experimentation, or spacecraft piloting. Now, obviously, that covers a lot of ground. The journeyman had all sorts of systems on board, from life support to artificial gravity generation, the not-quite-functional temporal dampeners, to some customized recreational systems. Honestly, I didn't think anyone would have a problem with this phase of the training. It was a lot, yes, but every single member of the crew was quite intelligent and a quick study. While NASA had similar systems to train on in their facility, some of the customized systems were unique to the journeyman, and crew members would need a little personalized review time in order to become familiar with them. Which was fine, as I could step in and instruct in their operation when we were in space. The main focus of the training would be on critical systems like life support, which were fairly universal for spacecraft. And like I said, everyone performed wonderfully. Since Space Chef Jillian was a little behind as she was replacing Beverly, she made it a point to do the extra training on her own time to catch up. She even paid for the centrifuge operator's overtime. I mean, that wasn't necessary. It's not like the government was about to run out of money. Or so they tell me, anyway. In any case, Jillian was completely caught up and dove into the systems training. Now, NASA didn't have a space galley for her to train on, but I had the NASA engineers cobble together one from ship parts to simulate a spacecraft. It was the best we could do on short notice, and the NASA engineers did a fine, fine job. I personally went over the differences and nuances of a space galley versus a ship galley, and Jillian took copious notes. Janet, the mission specialist, and I then both checked in with the rest of the crew to see how they were faring with the internal events training. Our communications and linguistics officer, Stephen, not Steve, was predictably drawn to the communication systems the most, and that was, of course, to be expected. Still, every member of the crew needed some working knowledge of the other systems, like life support and the defense systems. And yes, NASA has defense systems, as does my spacecraft, the Journeyman. But it's not for what you think. I'll explain that later as well, but for now, we needed every member of the crew to at least have a high-level understanding of each system. As expected, each crew member tended to gravitate more towards the systems that interested them the most. Dolores, our mercenary-slash-security officer, was very interested in the defense systems and was a bit surprised as to how they worked. I explained that was by design and would explain more on the way. Janet also said she would be happy to explain them, but Dolores seemed to want me to go over them instead, and I could see I may have another personnel issue brewing. But it couldn't be helped. No one was being deliberately difficult. It was their work duties and responsibilities that were at odds, and both Janet and Dolores took those very seriously. Now, Aaron, our retired Air Force medic, had an interest in both the medical systems and the life support systems, and said as a medic, they went hand in hand, obviously, and he needed to be intimately familiar with both. He also asked about the recreational systems and added that he liked to, quote, work hard and then play hard, even in space. He would also be bringing his recreational eye patch, but I had a suspicion that it looked remarkably similar to his work and training eye patches. Aaron also asked about the physical fitness gym systems for the journeyman, as he liked to keep in tip-top shape. Since we were going to have our own artificial gravity, I told him our physical fitness gym systems were just a gym, and he would have access to it any time, day or night. He smiled, realized I was, of course, making a joke. There wasn't really any day or night in space. Aaron also spent some extra time with Jillian and asked a lot of questions about the menu. Jillian assured him the crew would have the best cuisine a space mission would allow. Aaron did request astronaut ice cream that they sell in museum gift shops. This caught Jillian by surprise, as she was planning to bring actual ice cream, but she said she would see what she could do. I had no doubt we would have astronaut ice cream on the menu after that day. Now, Jillian was the only one who didn't gravitate towards a favorite system other than the space galley systems, which were more just recipe and ingredient manifests and databases. Jillian smiled and said she had her own system for those, and once she understood how things worked in the space galley and was aware of the differences from a ship galley, she said she would take it from there. However, she still did an excellent job at learning the other systems as a backup. I mean, the truth is, if your space chef is the one operating or repairing your life support or defense systems, the mission has gone quite south. With enough preparation, I was determined to not let that happen. There was one system that was exclusive to Dolores, although I looped our medic Aaron in, who was, of course, very supportive. Janet had created a specific training module that dealt with astrophobia to help Dolores overcome her fear of space. There would be a VR component, which we would get to a bit later, but for now, Dolores reviewed the module and the tools and resources she would have access to during the mission. While Janet was supportive, she was still a little apprehensive about Dolores' fitness for space duty, but said she would keep an open mind throughout the rest of the training. I had complete faith in Dolores and would go to bat for her if need be, as would Bradley, of course, in the event Janet was on the fence. I was also observing Bradley's performance as he took these courses as a refresher. Bradley liked going into space and was looking forward to it. He focused mostly on how the systems had evolved and updated since the last time we were spacebound. Also, he supported Dolores and the other crew members who were learning these systems for the first time. All in all, both Janet and myself were quite pleased with the way the crew came through the internal systems training with flying colors, and I was growing more and more confident about the crew's abilities as we added some much-needed redundancy to the crew's knowledge base. It was tiring, and the crew was exhausted by the end. To celebrate getting through another training module, that night we had a special breakfast for dinner event, and everyone enjoyed the space shuttle waffles from the NASA cafeteria, along with a large red velvet cake in the shape of Mars. The next day, it was time for external events training. Now, external events refers more broadly to the ability to live and work in the extreme environment of space. This includes adaptation to microgravity, or weightlessness, isolation, confinement, and radiation. The difficulty associated with living and working in microgravity includes spatial disorientation, motion sickness, and vertigo. During long-duration missions, astronauts will often experience isolation and confinement. This has been known to limit the performance of astronaut crews, and hence training aims to prepare astronauts for such challenges. The long-term effects of radiation on crews is still largely unknown. However, it is theorized that astronauts on a trip to Mars will likely receive more than 1,000 times the radiation dosage of a typical person on Earth. As such, present and future training must incorporate systems and processes for protecting astronauts against radiation. Now, the journeyman has ways to minimize and counteract this, with radiation dampeners built into the hull, and we were always improving our spacesuits. Still, it was a concern, and one we took seriously. Weightlessness and spacewalk training was normally very extensive, but we just didn't have time for it, and we would have to rely on the other crew members who were full astronauts in case the need arose for a full-on spacewalk. Now, NASA uses an interesting method to prepare astronauts for weightlessness. They use a neutral buoyancy pool or tank, which is a pool of water in which neutral buoyancy is used to train astronauts for extravehicular activity and the development of procedures. These pools began to be used in the 1960s and were initially just recreational swimming pools. Dedicated facilities would later be built. Now, just a note too about the confusing label of extravehicular activity, or EVA. It often has nothing to do with vehicles. It more refers to the skill of spacewalking in zero gravity. I mean, why not just call it spacewalking? Well, it is the government, so there's always an added layer of extraneous confusion, often on purpose. Now, prior to May 1960, NASA recognized the possibility of underwater neutral buoyancy simulations and began testing their efficacy. NASA engaged Environmental Research Associates, a company based in Baltimore, to try neutral buoyancy simulations first in a pool near Langley Research Center. Visitors and other issues disturbed those efforts, possibly also the CIA complaining about the noise, so they moved the operation to a swimming pool at the McDonough School in Maryland, where Scott Carpenter was the first astronaut to participate suited. Then, after difficult EVAs through Gemini 11 in mid-September 1966, the Manned Spacecraft Center, later renamed the Johnson Space Center, fully understood the importance of testing procedures underwater and sent the Gemini 12 crew to train at McDonough. Interestingly, the crew thoroughly enjoyed this part of the training, especially Jillian, our space chef. Since she was an oceanic chef, she was very at home on or in the water. Aaron, our retired Air Force medic, brought a survival knife into the water and was swimming around with it in his teeth. Combined with his training eye patch and his impeccable physique, the truth was he would have made an excellent pirate. I then explained he would need to train in the spacesuit, so he returned in a few minutes with a smaller survival knife that would fit in his helmet. At that point, Janet stepped in and informed Aaron that safety issues in the neutral buoyancy tank prohibited mouth knives, so he would need to leave them in his quarters. Aaron reluctantly complied and said he had switched to his disappointed eye patch, which again looked exactly like his training one. Bradley and Dolores were doing a tandem spacewalk underwater, which I expected. The truth is, I wondered how seriously the crew was taking this part of the training. I mean, when you combine the crew knowing they would most likely not be called upon to engage in a spacewalk, with the fun of being in a pool, it created a lighter atmosphere than Janet or I would have liked. Still, fun was good for morale, and Janet understood that as well. So with the exception of removing Aaron's mouth knives, we didn't interfere. After everyone rested a bit, the crew was ready for the second-to-last training module. It would be a multi-day affair, and it was my favorite one. Scientific experimentation. Now, while technically we were going on more of an investigative and rescue mission, scientific experimentation may hold the key to what we would encounter, and we had to be prepared. This was one of the modules I wanted truncated as little as possible, as I knew how important it may be, depending on what we found on the journey. Now, scientific experimentation has historically been an important element of human spaceflight, and is the primary focus of the International Space Station. Training on how to successfully carry out these experiments is an important part of astronaut training, as it maximizes the scientific return of the mission. Once on orbit, communication between astronauts and scientists on the ground can be limited, and time is strictly apportioned between different mission activities. It is vital that astronauts are familiar with their assigned experiments in order to complete them in a timely manner, with as little intervention from the ground as possible. For missions to the ISS, International Space Station, each astronaut is required to become proficient at 100 or more experiments. During training, Scientists responsible for the experiments do not have direct contact with the astronauts who will be carrying them out. Instead, scientists instruct trainers who in turn prepare the astronauts for carrying out the experiment. Much of this training is done at the European Astronaut Center. For human experiments, the scientists describe their experiments to the astronauts who then choose whether to participate on board the ISS. For these experiments, the astronauts will be tested before, during, and after the mission to establish a baseline and determine when the astronaut returned to that baseline. Now, we wouldn't be doing any human experiments, obviously. Well, at least not intentionally. So the focus would be on other fields like geology, seismology, linguistics, anthropology, astrophysics, and architecture. Yes, I did say architecture. Unsurprisingly, this is where Bradley shone, and I could see how proud Dolores was of him. I broke up all the disciplines for experimentation as best I could, but still, there was a lot of ground to cover, and the crew took to it all and treated it seriously. There was a little bit of puzzlement on a few of the experiments, and I could see on the crew members' faces a few looks of, am I really going to need this? Especially during the flora and fauna biology sessions. But again, these modules were more important than both Janet and I were letting on, and the more preparation, the better. The experimentation module was then finished, and soon after, the crew could see the finish line. This was it. We were at the final training module. It was virtual reality based and encompassed a lot of the other training modules and put them all together to simulate a full mission experience. You see, virtual reality training gives the astronaut candidates a fully immersive and more comprehensive training experience. Virtual reality has been explored as a technology to artificially expose astronauts to space conditions and procedures prior to going into space. Using virtual reality, astronauts can be trained and evaluated on performing an EVA with all the necessary equipment and environmental features simulated. This modern technology also allows the scenario to be changed on the go, such as to test emergency protocols. The VR training systems can reduce the effects of space motion sickness through a process of habituation. Pre-flight VR training can be a countermeasure for space motion sickness and disorientation due to the weightlessness of the microgravity environment. When the goal is to act as a practice tool, virtual reality is commonly explored in conjunction with robotics and additional hardware to increase the effect of immersion or the engagement of the trainee. Now, this is also where we would be monitoring Dolores closely to see how she reacted to a fully immersive space environment and to see how serious her astrophobia was. The VR training was more application of what was previously learned than anything new, but it strung things together, such as an issue with the life support system to avoiding a meteor shower. Now, our flight commander wasn't here, so they got a pass on that section, and we automated it. We watched Dolores experience a VR spacewalk, and while it was difficult, she was able to manage it. In the VR simulation, she then accessed some of the calming astrophobia modules Janet had provided, and that seemed to help. I was convinced Dolores could handle things, but Janet was still on the fence. As I planned, I went to bat for her and convinced Janet to give her the chance. Janet trusted me in my judgment and eventually agreed. Dolores was officially on the crew and had passed the training modules. Okay, now I know I said that was the final training module, but that wasn't quite the case. It was the last official training module. There was one left, and one only a few astronauts saw, including my son. Janet and I brought the crew to an elevator they hadn't seen before, and she reiterated the need for discretion, stemming from the sensitive nature of what they were about to see. Everyone understood and experienced a mixture of curiosity and slight nervousness, which was perfectly normal as astronauts approached the red elevator for the first time. When the large elevator doors opened, there were audible gasps. Janet and I walked ahead, and we welcomed the crew to the Mars Planetary Underground Field Simulation. The rock formations were carved and not natural, and there were clear roads and paths. I told the crew I was sure they had a lot of questions, but for now all they really needed to know was that yes, Mars was inhabited, and the inhabitants lived underground. All the forward-facing Mars probes and missions were on the surface, but that's not where this mission would take us. The crew started all talking at once, except for Aaron, who was taking it all in silently. This is where Janet became a bit concerned, but I assured her everyone could handle it. I added that the Journeyman wasn't the only place with artificial gravity, but we would still need spacesuits for temperature and oxygen regulation. I didn't add, until we got to the inner city, because I knew when an idea was too big, it was best to break it up into smaller, more digestible chunks. The crew slowly began exploring the roads and paths, with Janet and I observing everything from their vitals to their crew-to-crew chatter. Anxiousness soon turned to intellectual curiosity and excitement, validating each and every one of my crew choices. Even Janet relaxed. I couldn't be happier with everyone's performance. And it was a good thing, because the abbreviated astronaut training was now over, and it would be time to leave as soon as we returned to Los Angeles. And I will tell you all about our blastoff into outer space next time. But before I end this evening's story, I want to talk to you about something. Now, we've talked about an open mindset versus a fixed mindset. The minimum requirement for success is an open mindset in work and in life. You have to be open to new things and new ideas, even things that challenge your current viewpoints and perspectives. Since we are constantly being given new information, it should be processed, not ignored. And it's an easy trap to fall into, believe me. You could spend years writing a thesis about the rules of mammals, and then a platypus waddles into your lab and lays an egg. That's actually not a metaphor. That happened to Professor Gregg. He is still in therapy, but doing much better. But my point is, some things are too big to accept all at once, so it's better to do it in stages. That's why the simulated Mars terrain is only terrain and deliberately leaves out the inhabitants, the pets, and the architecture. It would be too much at once. So it's okay to be slow to change your mind and process new information. Just don't ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. Denial is the enemy of growth. Every science experiment brings us closer to the truth. What's interesting is sometimes we think we're there, but we're actually only halfway. So keep experimenting, keep learning, and keep being open to new ideas. The best part? You're not the only one who's still learning. You'll meet awesome travelers along the way who are all on a similar journey. Good night, adventurers.
The Quiet Journeys of Professor Atwood was created, written, and performed by Chris Mancini and produced by White Cat Entertainment. It is a work of fiction. Maybe. Music and sound design by Ron Tansky at rontanskymusic.com. For more info and merchandise, including t-shirts, mugs, and blankets, go to whitecatentertainment.com.
Membership fees apply after free trial. Cancel any time.
Okay, so why do people love my Total Body Bar workouts? Because they work. My clients get an amazing workout and great results. I'm Andrea Rogers, professional dancer and trainer, and my Extend Bar classes are fun, only 30 minutes, and proven to help you get sculpted, lean, and strong. And right now, you can stream my Extend Bar classes for free on the Beachbody On Demand app. See how effective these workouts truly are. Start for free today at Beachbody.com.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, we'll use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.